From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. With Twitter's permanent suspension of Donald Trump's account, the president has lost his direct megaphone to tens of millions of Americans. Trump effectively used his social media accounts to generate headlines, deflect attention, praise his supporters, direct their fury, castigate his political enemies, and subvert traditional media gatekeepers. Now, some on the left are warning that silencing Trump and his supporters is a violation of their free speech rights that could come back to haunt the left. My guest is Melissa Figueroa, PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley and faculty owner at the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice. She's been a longtime political educator and organizer involved in a wide range of movements for social and environmental justice in California. She's also a correspondent for our program. Welcome back, Melissa.
Thank you, Sonali.
So this conversation is not going to focus on the legal definition of the First Amendment and whether Twitter is violating it or not, because you're not a law professor. I'm not a legal expert. We're going to leave that to the legal experts. What I want to discuss with you is the morality, the ethics, and also the fear on the left that silencing the far right could be the beginning of the silencing of the left. What are you seeing, first of all, on some sectors of the left in terms of criticism of Twitter's silencing of Trump?
Yeah, so after this coup that was openly organized on social media, including people saying directly, kill security, kill operatives, kill lawmakers, and people posting what weapons they were bringing, people posting selfies while they were doing this, all kinds of stuff. A number of people, and Twitter banned Trump for saying some words like walk to the Capitol that seemed to directly incite this insurrection that happened on Wednesday, January 6th. Now, a lot of folks, now Twitter's banning of Trump and these inflammatory words and these folks from the mainstream social media platforms are choosing this moment to point out some valid criticisms of the selective nature of banning people and having tech companies have control over information that gets out and everything. And, not to dismiss those as not valid concerns, because yes, we should always take a critical view of how much power that companies and tech companies have in our lives. But to do this in the context of something that is so blatantly, and I will get into the legalities here because it's important, a First Amendment violation. Brandenburg versus Ohio in 1969 was an opinion that a Supreme Court opinion that affirmed the fact that speech inciting violence, where violence is or is likely to occur, is not protected by the First Amendment. Right. So we want to draw a categorical distinction between, say, silencing people on the internet who say things like Black Lives Matter or that we should have equal rights versus people who are literally directly and in the case of a GOP congresswoman tweeting the location of Nancy Pelosi so a murderous armed mob could get to her. These are two categorically different things. They're two different things legally. And the more that we try to equate this because we are in fear that it's going to happen to us, which it already is happening to us. Like, it's not the beginning of repression for the left. We've already been dealing with it. And so collapsing that distinction gives the effect, the actual, outcome effect of giving cover to people who are not in the interests of equal rights, who are actually murderous and advocating for genocide, and in at this point have actually attempted to overthrow the US government.
So the content of the discourse, the content of the posts and the conversation matters, right? Because I think that's an issue that doesn't get raised, because those who say that Twitter shouldn't silence Trump are suggesting that that his speech, his supporters' speech, is the same as anyone's speech, any organizer's speech, but that's not true. The content matters. You don't have unlimited free speech rights in this country, no matter what some would like to say.
Absolutely. You can't yell fire in a theater. You cannot say bomb in an airport. You actually could not, up until this point, this administration could not actually, threaten the president of the United States before those were all things that were accepted exceptions to the First Amendment. There's a lot of inflammatory rhetoric going around on either side, but there are clear legal distinctions. And also we have to look at, if I say I wanted to launch a billionaire to the sun, that's free speech because I don't have a rocket and I'm not about to launch a billionaire into the sun, right?
I see.
If
the context matters as well, the realistic nature of what you're saying matters.
Absolutely. If people are standing 100 feet away from Mike Pence and saying, hang Mike Pence, and armed and about to rush him, that's a little more clear cut than that.
You're absolutely not and never have been a supporter of Mike Pence, but it matters to you
exactly.
that people are calling for the death of the right-wing vice president.
Right. I mean, like I said, I'm not a fan of Mike Pence. Like, honestly, if something happens to him, I'd probably shrug. But at the same time, I'm not equating my calls for replacing capitalism with a better system, and even if this, having a better government, to literally standing 100 feet away from somebody and calling for his death while people are armed sitting next to me, right?
So one of the concerns is that social media companies are not government entities. They are the ones who create the standards and then decide how to apply them. And we know from the past that they do get applied quite inconsistently. And then others make the case that because so much of our discourse now happens on social media, that even though they are private companies, they really ought to be treated as a public commons. All of those are considerations though, aren't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the point that, social media companies do have discretion because they are private companies, and private companies have the discretion to selectively, right, limit people's speech and also give privileges to others, to other speech. Right. If social media companies, as the current monopolies that they are, were actually socialized and the public had, and it was a public utility, and people had a say in the regulation of these things, then they would actually have to abide by the First Amendment. And that means that something like Black Lives Matter or expressing outrage over police murder would be permitted speech, and tweeting Nancy Pelosi's location to an armed mob would still be banned, or tell an armed mob to walk to the Capitol and then storm the Capitol would still not be acceptable. But the arbitrariness of it is a valid concern, and I get that. And I'm just saying, doing that now is having the effect of reinforcing the privilege that right-wing groups have had on these platforms for years.
And it also makes it creates a false equivalence between Black Lives Matter or anti-fascist activism and the Trumpist coup and its project of ethnic cleansing. I mean, for that equivalence to come from the left is a little disturbing, or from some parts of the left, I should say.
Well, and I think where that equivalents, false equivalences come from, I think are two things. And one of them comes from, you know, this sort of liberal acceptance of an abstract principle of free speech as being somehow above the material consequences of that abstract principle. In Berkeley in 2017, I saw this firsthand as, you know, people were tweeting death threats. I was being stalked and doxxed on Twitter. Other folks were being stalked and doxxed on Twitter and 8chan and all of these platforms.
And just to clarify for our audience, doxxing is when the personal information of a user is exposed on social media in order to basically implicitly threaten them.
Absolutely, yes. And so, you know, what I saw happening was that these right-wing groups and these fascists understood the commitment to the absolute principle that is hegemonic or prevalent in our society. So what they were able to do was literally sort of kind of ring like a Pavlov's bell, kind of like free speech, and then all of a sudden all these people would be debating the free speech rights of somebody to advocate violence while the violence was actually happening to the person. Mm-hmm. So yes, an abstract principle of free speech in a democratic society is very useful and it works, but you can't take it out of context. You cannot decontextualize a principle from the material realities on the ground in which the work that it does and it operates. If we look at the statistics on politically motivated violence, 90% of all politically motivated violence and murders in the United States is attributed to the right wing. This has increased in the last 4 years. And so when we, and if you look at the last 25 years, zero of politically motivated deaths have been attributed to the left wing. And I would say that's actually probably incorrect. There's one, the one man who tried to a solo armed assault on an ICE facility to rescue children. That is the one politically motivated death connected to the left wing, and it wasn't even about killing anybody. The person just had a very poorly conceived plan, unfortunately, and that was it. So you can't take this principle out of this context of violence, everyday violence that is happening to the communities that are being targeted by the right wing. And when you do that, I want to say, it actually serves the fascist purpose by getting everybody distracted into a conversation about a concept while actual violence is happening on the ground. I've been seeing this happen for years, and that's one of the reasons why I realized it was a trap. It's a trap, and it's a trap motivated by the politics of fear. Right. If you are somehow defending, you know, somebody's ability to organize an attempted coup on social media because you're in fear that the social media company might do the same thing for you for demanding rights, equal rights, then you're still motivated by fear. And so I want above all to protect vulnerable people in our communities. I want to see the reality of equal rights for all people become a reality in my lifetime. And in order to do that, I need to not be motivated by the politics of fear. I need to understand the rules and limitations of a democratic society, directed by the rule of law. And, you know, if that has to force me to become a better strategist and tactician to go towards my goals, so be it.
And Melissa, isn't it important for us to remind ourselves that it's government's job to protect all people and our lives? And people of color, LGBTQ people, immigrants, our lives have been threatened by white supremacists and white supremacy. It is very analogous to Nazi Germany's threats to Jewish people. Although their plan was actualized, the white supremacists would like to actualize what the Nazis did, and we certainly can't wait for them to begin doing it before saying human lives are more important than the right for genocidal maniacs to spout genocidal mania.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a very painful process for me of this realization. And, you know, part of me is weirdly thankful I encountered the worst, you know, directly years ago, because I have a lot more clarity now that it has basically erupted into the mainstream. And let's not forget, it already did erupt into the mainstream with Charlottesville. And so, you know, if Charlottesville is the tragedy and January 6th is the farce, I guess that's how the way it goes. But, you know, having seen this in real time and having seen people sort of evade this very difficult question of how to protect communities while also protecting the rights of a democratic society by, you know, kind of harping on the free speech bell. And I mean, I've sat in rooms where people were talking about Berkeley at the time that you know these Proud Boys and these other groups were threatening.
That's right. We had you on our program when these far right figures were coming to campuses in California and they were being welcomed by authorities under the guise of free speech.
Yeah, and you know, literally sitting in some of these rooms and having people who are social justice, you know, committed social justice activists saying, well, maybe somebody might just have to get hurt, or maybe somebody has to die before the public wakes up. Well, it's 3 years later, a lot of other more people are dead or are injured or have been permanently traumatized by these groups. And I'm still waiting. Right? Like how many more people are going to have to sacrifice their lives until we actually understand the threat that is in front of us? And there is no, address this. A lot of Biden right now is considering a whole host of new domestic terrorism laws to prosecute this. And he doesn't need to, right? That is something that leftists can critique. If they just enforce the laws on the books like everybody else without the privilege that these folks who are in law enforcement, so a lot of the folks who stormed the Capitol were in law enforcement, a lot of folks are influential, you know, people in their own communities. If the law was actually applied equally without those privileges, the laws on the books are enough.
Right. I mean, a lot of elected officials, unfortunately, feel that legislative action in the wake of terrorist attacks is the way to go. I mean, we saw that after September 11th. In fact, there are laws, you know, there were plenty of laws that were broken that these rioters could be charged with, are being charged with already. So it's really interesting to see, you know, an equal application of those laws would already get us there. Now, I want to bring up the fact that one of the figures that is being raised to point out that Twitter is violating free speech or that's dangerous to celebrate Trump's suspension of Twitter is Senator Ron Paul, who was apparently temporarily blocked by Facebook for violating community standards. It's being claimed that he was blocked after he had made some critique of the tech industry. And so immediately you had folks saying, see, this is what happens when you champion private companies like Twitter and Facebook for you know, silencing figures like Trump. How do you respond to that?
Well, Ron Paul is an interesting figure to take as a example of this. You know, Ron Paul has, you know, is very, you know, loved across the spectrum for being a champion for civil liberties, but he is also a racist. And he also has, you know, given cover to some of these groups, because of an abstract principle and not the lived reality of what it means to be in a community threatened by fascist thugs. You know, it's it reminds me of that there are two different definitions of freedom that operate in American society. For marginalized and underprivileged and repressed, historically oppressed groups, freedom for us means freedom of self-determination, freedom to exercise our rights as democratic citizens in a democratic society, and freedom of opportunity. But there's also another definition of freedom that operates, you know, precisely and specifically amongst white supremacists and people who have benefited from the white supremacist nature of U.S. society, and that is freedom from consequences.
Hmm.
I mean, honestly, like, even look, hypothetically, right? Even if I wanted to storm the Capitol in a revolution, which is, that's not even how you overthrow government these days anyway, right? It's not 1383, right? But even if I did, right? And I said that on Twitter and I did it and I lost, I would fully expect to have the power of the state and the punitive power of the state come down on me because, well, that's, you know, you tried to overthrow the government. The fact that, like, people are now debating whether or not these folks should face a consequence for something that they did that did not succeed is the definition of privilege.
Finally, Melissa, how laughable is it to you that Donald Trump and many of his supporters are now looking at the Capitol riot as a result of Antifa infiltration? It's pretty interesting because on the one hand, they see Ashley Babbitt, the woman who was killed by Capitol Police, as a martyr. She was very obviously a Trump supporter. And on the other hand, they're saying it's Antifa. There are some very well-known figures that are easily identifiable that are longtime Trump supporters, but still Antifa.
I would absolutely hope that to anyone who has half a brain and is watching that they know that's not true. And to the others who might not be watching critically and might believe these folks, this is why lies have to be fought on the narrative level, on the social level, and in a court and in courts of law. So, you know, in a weird way, I kind of hope we're all anti-fascists now, but and if this incident and the lies around it help to create more anti-fascists, I'm here for it.
Melissa, I want to thank you so much for joining us. As always, appreciate your time and insight.
Okay, thank you.
My guest has been Melissa Figueroa, PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley and faculty owner at the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice and a correspondent for our program. We've been discussing whether social media companies are silencing free speech by blocking extremist discourse. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.